Thank you and good evening and welcome. I've got a few slides. What I thought I would do is begin by just looking at some of the definitions so that we're clear about what we're talking about. In my experience, even talking sometimes with medical doctors, they're not always clear about some of the nuances and some of the different understandings. So I'll set that up. And some people may want to disagree with that, but I'll certainly set it up from is how I understand it. I do want to say something about the proposed end-of-life choice bill, just very briefly, and highlight some aspects of it and just situate that in the current context. And then say a little bit about how I come at it, how I understand it from a Catholic perspective. So euthanasia, firstly, it's simple definition, the intentional causing of death in order that suffering may be eliminated. Or we might say it's an act undertaken by someone with a specific intention of ending another person's life. And of course, the fact that it's done for the purpose of ending another person's suffering is what distinguishes it from other acts of homicide. Okay, at the end of the day, it is an act of homicide. Whether we like using that word or not, we are talking about the intentional killing of another person. Physician-assisted suicide is where the person administers a lethal substance that has been prescribed by a physician. So there is a distinction between euthanasia and assisted suicide. And the proposed end-of-life choice bill was seeking to make both available in New Zealand. Euthanasia is voluntary if it is done with the consent and at the request of the patient. It is non-voluntary when it is done without the consent or request of a patient who can't give that consent. And there are sometimes reasons for that. If we are thinking about neonates, for example, there is no way that they can give consent. If we are talking about somebody who is in a coma or maybe somebody with dementia, again, if they haven't given that consent and if a decision is made to euthanize them, that is what we refer to as non-voluntary euthanasia. The third category is what we might call involuntary euthanasia, which is when it's done to a patient who had either explicitly stated they didn't want to be killed, in which case people say, well, isn't that murder? Or if it was done to someone who was actually capable of being asked and giving an opinion and they weren't asked. So those are sort of three subcategories in regard to euthanasia. Just very quickly, something about the bill. It was first put forward into the private members' ballot in 2012 by Mary Ann Street. It was then withdrawn last year after a discussion with their own caucus, and my understanding was that was done with a view to the upcoming election and the fact they didn't want that to be a distraction. The proposed bill as it was then, and look, nobody really knows what's going to happen with it. Mary Ann Street did say that in the event she didn't get back into Parliament that she would seek to actually have somebody else sponsor it, and I suspect that is what will eventually happen. But the particular bill, the parameters of it, a person could make a request for medical assistance to end his or her life, provided they were 18, provided they were mentally competent, and that was attested to by two medical practitioners. Okay, so those are the parameters. Now, the person would need to suffer a terminal illness which is likely to cause death within 12 months, which is very, very difficult to predict, actually, and we have a palliative physician who'll be on the panel later if you want to talk a bit about that. It's a long period of time. Or if they suffer from an irreversible physical or mental condition. A lot of people don't actually realise the scope of the particular bill. A physical or mental condition that is irreversible and that in the person's view would render their life unbearable, in the person's view. I think that's quite important. So, people with depression and mental illness would not be protected from euthanasia or assisted suicide in the form of the bill as it was proposed at that time. The bill defines the criteria for euthanasia as having physical or psychological pain, as I said, which cannot be relieved in a manner the person deems tolerable. And persons who live with chronic depression or mental illness could, in fact, qualify for that, even if they rejected ineffective treatment on the basis that they found that treatment or didn't actually want that treatment. So, in other words, my reading of it is that the proposed bill would offer physician-assisted suicide or physician-assisted euthanasia to persons suffering from incurable but relatively common conditions such as heart and lung disease, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, insulin-dependent diabetes and arthritis, including, as I've said, mental illness such as depression. My own father, who is 88 years of age, who doesn't actually have a terminal condition of any sort would qualify for the bill as it was set up, as proposed. I want to go to the abstract, which some of you may have seen, which was advertising this particular seminar, and it asked a number of questions. And I'm going to use that as a way of sort of segueing into the Catholic understanding of this. Are there situations in which ending the suffering of a sick person can be justified? So I've got four comments I want to make about that. The first one is that neither assisted euthanasia or assisted suicide actually deal with the suffering of a sick person. You might say, well, that's counterintuitive. They actually, and maybe you think I'm being pedantic, but they actually kill the person who is suffering. They don't actually deal with the suffering. And the way this statement is sometimes phrased implies that without assisted suicide or assisted euthanasia, without the opportunity to legally choose that, that people are locked into pain and suffering. The argument is often set up as if there is a sort of a dichotomy. For me, it's a false dichotomy. And when you look at palliative care, and I know that's not necessarily the point of difference between those who favour euthanasia and those who are opposed to it, but when you look at palliative care, it actually aims, its whole focus is to address suffering in its various manifestations, including the physical and including the existential forms of suffering, but I would add, from my perspective, in an ethical way. Ultimately, for me, assisted euthanasia and assisted suicide would add to the suffering of some individuals and society as a whole, and that's sort of the crux of my particular argument against it. The fourth point is just to say that when you look at the literature, when you look at the research that has been done overseas, and I've read a lot of this material and read it extensively, that the common drivers for assisted euthanasia and assisted suicide, the reasons why people request it, are not, in the first instance, pain-related. Pain comes fifth or sixth down the list, and the key drivers are twofold, and this research has actually been replicated in New Zealand. They are social isolation, people who are socially isolated, people who are alone, who are no longer connected into a community, and secondly, the fear of being a burden. Those are the reasons why people persistently request assisted suicide or euthanasia. The abstract also asks the question, can euthanasia be safely implemented? And for me, that is the key ethical question. And so I would argue, and I have argued, that it's actually, ethically speaking, consistent to be personally or ideologically in favour of euthanasia or assisted suicide, perhaps, you know, thinking about some of those very, very difficult cases, and they are difficult cases. But at the same time, to be opposed to its legalisation. And I know a number of key New Zealanders, prominent New Zealanders, including a prominent judge, or actually a couple of judges, who I can't name because of their position, who have both said to me that they have some sympathy for the hard cases, but who are adamantly opposed to the legalisation of either euthanasia or assisted suicide because of the consequences, because of the inability of the law to actually keep people safe, vulnerable people safe. That is a cogent response. And so I often say to people, I don't actually set out to change people's minds about whether or not they should personally feel sympathetic towards euthanasia. The key issue for me is, can we implement this safely and can we keep it safe? Similarly, it's possible to be ideologically opposed to euthanasia and accept its legalisation. I know a number of people who argue that way as well because they don't want to impose their particular choice or their particular perspective onto other people. For me, the key and urgent contribution of the Abrahamic faiths is around the social dangers of a law change, and it flows out of what I've just said, that I think the key question, in fact, is around the safety. It's not a distinctive contribution in the sense of being a unique or a religious perspective, and I think that speaks for itself. So the question, the abstract also asks, what is the distinctive contribution that the Abrahamic faiths might bring to this important debate? It's an interesting question, and we could have a whole evening on that, just discussing that question. Personally, I think the rise of euthanasia can be located within a broader societal and Western cultural paradigm shift with its roots in the Enlightenment. And it's interesting, when you look at the countries where this question is arising. It tends to be the wealthy Western countries with the best medical systems. Often the countries too where secularisation has taken a hold. It's not, as a rule, coming out of the third world poorer countries. I think that's interesting. I think it supports that particular theory. And I see that, if you like, if I could use that metaphor of the war. But as I said, the key ethical question for me is whether the law can be safely implemented. That's the battle that I think we're engaged in at the moment. And as someone who comes out of a religious tradition, we can't win that battle by taking a religious approach. In Washington State, which is one of two states in America where assisted suicide is legal, a poll was done after it was legalized, and it was done through a referendum. And the perception afterwards was that the only people who were opposed to the legalization of assisted suicide were those who were religious, because it was only the churches who actually spoke up at the time. So religious arguments, religious language isn't actually going to win the battle for us. And yet at the same time, I think we must, and as churches we're in a unique position to make a distinctive contribution to what I've called the war, to address some of those broader underlying drivers, if you like, which have brought this question to the fore at a time when palliative care, when pain relief, when our medical systems have never ever been better able to actually address the questions of physical suffering. So, if we could put it like this, religious traditions are, I think, in a good position to underline what I would call the distortive effects of individualism. And if we had more time, we could unpack that a bit more. But that's essentially what I mean by the sort of that question coming out of the whole Enlightenment debate and the cultural shift that happened as a result of the Enlightenment. Now, an earlier version of that abstract, and it didn't actually go out, I think, also posed the question, should people who wish to die be forced to stay alive? I've added that in, and I think it's an interesting question, because it's a question that people often put to me, as if that is the alternative. And again, what I would say very quickly to that is, to oppose euthanasia is not to force people to stay alive, it's to refuse to cooperate in the killing of persons or of another person. And the Catholic understanding, the tradition that I come out of, is that we neither hasten death nor do we unnecessarily prolong life. And that mirrors, as I understand it, very much the hospice philosophy. So for me, euthanasia is defined by intention. And if we decide for medical reasons to withdraw or withhold certain treatments to allow the patient to return to their dying, that is not euthanasia. Again, when the intention is solely the relief of pain, then the use of pain relief is acceptable. I think people have a right to have their pain addressed. It's a critical thing. The use of pain relief is acceptable, even if we know that inadvertently, unintentionally, and regrettably, it might shorten the person's life. Some people refer to that as passive euthanasia, and they say, well, it's happening already. The difference, if you like, and one of the ways I try to explain it, is that if a doctor gives medication to relieve someone's pain, believes that it could shorten their life, but wants to do it to relieve their pain, if the doctor comes back 2 or 3 or 4 days later and that person's still alive, they don't consider that what they have done is a failure, provided they have kept that person out of pain. But if the person wants to actually kill the person, euthanize them, and you come back the following day or the second day and they're still alive, then according to intention, you have in fact failed what you were trying to do. So that's the distinction, and it's an important moral distinction, and it's critical, certainly, in the tradition that I work out of. Just a reminder too, Right 7 of the Code on Health and Disability Services Consumer Rights Act actually gives every consumer, every person, the right to refuse services and to withdraw consent to services. So for me, a robust ethical approach avoids what I would call vitalism, the idea that we have to do everything possible to keep people alive no matter what. It also avoids under-treatment. It's that via media, if you like. It's that sort of middle way and living with that tension. And that's what doctors, that's what palliative physicians do every day. Is there a Christian perspective? I'm supposedly standing here presenting the Christian perspective. And the first thing I'd say to that is I certainly don't represent all Christians. I speak for the New Zealand Catholic Bishops Conference, and I am articulating a Catholic perspective. And I would also have to say that there are many Catholics and many Christians who are divided over this question, despite the fact, certainly if you're Catholic, Catholic teaching on this is unequivocal. Okay, there is no wriggle room at all, and yet many, many Catholics don't necessarily agree with me on this for a whole lot of reasons, some of which I think are actually related to not actually understanding fully the complexities of this particular bill and what I would call the societal consequences, which for me is where the greatest dangers actually lie. For many people, it's a question of choice, and I'll say something about that in a minute. From a theological perspective, my own theological reflection on this leads me to think that it's a grave error to support euthanasia. But again, I don't think, as I said before, that that's the critical issue for me as a Catholic Christian, and certainly as someone who is the director of a Catholic Bioethics Centre. For me, as I said, the key question is one of safety. And in the writings that we've done, and in my own talking about this and debating about this, the key thing is around the safety of it. We could have an interesting theological debate about it, and there are some interesting biblical texts that we could tease out. At the end of the day, I don't think, actually think, other than perhaps being of interest to some of us who are immersed in scripture and theology, that's actually really going to get us very far. So in the work we've done and the writing we've done, and if you're familiar with it, you will notice that what we focus on is in fact that sort of protection of what I would call the vulnerable people and the social or societal consequences of this sort of law. And yet at the same time, while I wouldn't necessarily use religious language to talk about that, and while I wouldn't necessarily quote the scriptures, I could, but I usually don't, I would say that those arguments are fundamentally faithful to the key theological principles of the Catholic tradition, in particular the principles of social justice, which are affirmed in the scriptures, both the First Testament and the Second Testament. The argument, as I understand it, the key argument is really, why shouldn't the terminally ill meet death on their own terms rather than at the end of prolonged agonies? Why would we not be able to control the timing of our own death? And the assumption most people make is that legalising euthanasia will not adversely affect the freedom of those who don't want it. And I often hear it. People say, well, look, the current situation means that you get to make your choice. You don't want to use euthanasia, you don't like it, that's fair enough. But it doesn't allow us to make our choice. And by legalising it, you can still protect your choice, you don't have to use it. And I get to make my choice, and it's a free choice. And it's a powerful argument. It's an argument that does, in fact, have merit. I think it falls down when you consider, and for me this is perhaps the strongest argument against euthanasia, it falls down when you consider that we don't make our decisions, our choices, in a vacuum. And I would say that if there was any point in our history, in our New Zealand history, because we're talking about a New Zealand law, if there was any point in our New Zealand history when it was dangerous to legalise either euthanasia or assisted suicide, it's now. That we have never been at a point where it has been more dangerous. And I say that for a number of reasons. Growing numbers of elderly. The fact that we live in an ageist society, and you only have to look at the advertising, you only have to look at the articles, it's all around us. I talked to a friend of mine the other day. She's part of our parish. She's recently retired, and she said to me, you know, the older I get, the more I think I become invisible. We do live in an ageist society. The idea, the fear of becoming a burden, I've already talked briefly about that. The notion that the quality of life is tied into usefulness rather than simply being. And again, in New Zealand, if you look at where this question is coming from, where the demand for euthanasia is coming from, it is not as a rule coming out of the Polynesian cultures. It is not coming out of the Māori culture, even though I know some Māori who think it's a good idea, and I've met some Polynesians. But when, as a whole, those groups are opposed to this because they have come from a totally different understanding and understanding of what it is to be human, of what it is to be elderly. They come from a totally different point. They view their elderly in a totally different way. This is very much a cultural question. I think that's really important. We have to look at the growing problem of elder abuse. How am I going for time? Okay.
And if I could just say something about it, it's one of the fastest growing problems in the Western world. There are something like 1,000 cases of elder abuse that are confirmed every year by Age Concern. We know from overseas research that the number of cases of abuse that are reported are something like 16% of the real number. And when you do the maths on that, we're talking about 6,000 or 7,000 people in New Zealand who every year are being abused, elderly people who are being abused in some way, mostly by their families. You would also know, as I do, that the government, the rest home sector, Age Concern, Grey Power have put a lot of energy, a lot of time. There have been huge campaigns to try to stamp out elder abuse. And yet it continues to arise. It's continually on the rise. And if we think we can put safeguards in place to keep elderly people safe when euthanasia and assisted suicide are legalised, I think we're dreaming. And we only need to look at the effort and energy and money that is going in to try to stop elder abuse and realise how much it's growing to understand, I think, that we cannot, that it's impossible for the law to put in place cultural or safeguards that in fact will make it safe for those people who really don't want to die, but who will see that they have, in fact, no alternative. Okay, I'm going to finish there. And this is my last slide. And I guess that's an argument I quite often come to. For me, the danger is that the right to die that people are fighting for, some people are fighting for, will, in the current context, as I've described it, will actually become for many, many people a duty to die. Thank you very much.